From Washington, D.C., across the nation and around the world, stand by for an overview of the hottest topics and people being discussed on air, online, at the coffee shop and across the backyard fence, powered by the research of Talkers Magazine, The National Conversation. It's time for the Michael Harrison Wrap. Here's Michael Harrison.
Thank you, Victoria Jones. Monday, November 30th through Friday, December 4th, 2020. It was a week of worsening COVID-19 stats. Hope that the vaccines will have efficacy and efficiency. More first-time unemployment filings. The lives versus livelihoods debate. No stimulus package anywhere in sight. Continuing claims of election fraud. The coming together of a new administration. Rising anticipation of the Georgia runoff. Trouble with Iran. And a stock market showdown with China. Stand by, as we're about to be joined by influential voices from the right, left, and center. So be prepared to agree and disagree. We got it all. People with microphones, smartphones, and digital recording devices sharing their observations and the feelings of their target constituents with whom they do their daily dance of affirmation as we try to resist the modern-day syndrome of seeking victory at the expense of truth. Welcome to the Michael Harrison Wrap, an examination of the past week's hottest political and social topics discussed in the American talk media. Information is gathered from a variety of sources, including data tracked by the broadcasting trade publication Talkers Magazine, of which I'm editor and publisher. Okay, let's hear what they see and see what they say. Joining us now is Kevin Casey, executive editor of Talkers Magazine. Kevin, give us a rundown of the 10 most talked about stories on talk shows in America this past week.
Thank you, Michael. At number 10 this week, the UN Climate Change Report and the general topic of climate change. According to a report released this week by the United Nations Weather Agency, an overheating world obliterated weather records in 2020, creating an extreme year for hurricanes, wildfires, heat waves, floods, droughts, and ice melt.
And a year in which the politically controversial topic of climate change remained in the top 10 subjects discussed in the national conversation week after week.
At number 9, race relations tied with police reform. As Joe Biden puts his cabinet and administration together, the Black Lives Matter movement is watching each development carefully in preparation for the new executive branch and era ahead.
The forthcoming swearing-in of a woman of color as vice president and other changes in the diversity of the incoming administration indicate a potential turning point in America's national reckoning on racism. However, Biden will be facing a number of politically sensitive issues going forward and challenges on these matters within his own party, let alone having to deal with the GOP. Meantime, Democrats are quickly learning, partially as a result of losses suffered in the House and an erosion of their majority, that the idea of defunding police departments is not a very popular one among most American voters of all colors and ethnicities. Police reform, perhaps. Police defunding, no.
At number 8, the conservative media war is tied with ongoing accusations of major social media platform bias. Newsmax TV continues to make headway in its invasion of territory long occupied by Fox News Channel in terms of super-serving the loyal core of Trump followers who believe the election was rigged.
And that's a reflection of a larger argument among Republicans and conservatives about whether to hang in there and support the president on his legal quest to overturn the election or to simply move on.
At number 7, U.S.-China relations tied with Middle East tensions. The recent assassination of a leading Iranian nuclear scientist has raised tensions and hostilities by that nation toward the United States and Israel, whom they clearly suspect were behind the killing. This will undoubtedly impact Joe Biden's stated plans to have the U.S. re-enter the Iran nuclear treaty that was undone by President Trump.
Meantime, on the China front, the House of Representatives passed a bill this week that would prevent companies that refuse to open their books to U.S. accounting regulators from trading on U.S. stock exchanges. The legislation won unanimous backing in the Senate earlier this year, meaning it only needs President Donald Trump's signature to become law.
At number 6, the economy tied with the education crisis. The lives versus livelihood question is back on the front burner, with the deadly spike in coronavirus numbers sweeping the nation, and hundreds of thousands more first-time unemployment filings standing in the way of a smooth recovery. Not to mention the inability of the government to come up with a second stimulus package for financially stressed Americans and their businesses.
And the crisis in education intensifies as 2020 continues to be a year of sheer frustration for parents, teachers, and students.
At number five, Biden organizes new administration. So far, the president-elect has named Antony Blinken as his choice for Secretary of State, Alejandro Mayorkas as Secretary of Homeland Security, Avril Haines as Director of National Intelligence, Linda Thomas-Greenfield as U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Jake Sullivan as National Security Advisor, and John Kerry as Special Presidential Envoy for Climate.
He's announced earlier that Ron Klain, one of his most trusted campaign advisors, will serve as his incoming chief of staff, and Jen O'Malley Dillon, Biden's campaign manager, and Representative Cedric Richmond of Louisiana, a co-chair of Biden's transition team and presidential campaign, will serve in top roles in the White House. Of course, Biden's cabinet nominees will need to be confirmed by the U.S. Senate, which is currently controlled by Republicans. Two runoff elections in Georgia on January 5th could determine which party controls the chamber and impact the cabinet confirmation process.
At number four, the Georgia runoff Senate races. All eyes in the political universe are focused on the Peach State amidst controversy, political infighting, accusations, and a whole lot of advertising dollars being pumped into the crucial race.
Some observers are saying this runoff double election is almost as important as the presidential election itself because it holds the key to which party will control the Senate.
At number three, presidential pardons. Lots of buzz about the possibility of the president handing out preemptive pardons to his family, cronies, Rudy Giuliani, and possibly even himself.
And of course, the pot is being stirred further by indications that there might be a scandalous pay-for-pardons bribe scheme unfolding behind the scenes by White House operatives.
At number two, Trump continues to claim election fraud. Although the president has indicated that he will leave the White House peaceably on January 20 if his legal efforts are unsuccessful, he still has not backed off his claims that the election was stolen, that he is indeed the rightful winner, and that he will follow every legal road available to him in order to prove it.
But don't expect a concession speech to be forthcoming anytime soon, and the outgoing president might not even show up at the inauguration.
At number one this week, the COVID-19 numbers spike, vaccines, and prevention. Regardless of the promise of effective vaccines coming shortly, they can't seem to come quickly enough as the winter of 2020 approaches and the U.S. breaks records every day in terms of new cases and deaths due to the pandemic.
As of Friday, when this program is being produced, there are 14.2 million cases diagnosed in the United States, and the death count has surpassed 276,000. One of the immediate crises this has generated is the growing possibility of hospitals being swamped by new cases with not enough beds, supplies, and medical personnel to effectively handle the burden and flow. Welcome to December, the most wonderful time of the year. Thank you, Kevin Casey from Talkers Magazine. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap. Let's catch up now with one of the most respected and longest-running syndicated radio talk show hosts in America, a true legend, Jim Bohannon of the Westwood One Radio Network.
First of all, was there fraud? Yeah, of course, there's fraud in every election. Was there a lot of fraud? There seems to be abundant evidence that there was a lot of fraud, and I certainly hope that we go after one thing that's important in cases like this, and that is to find anyone who did in fact commit fraud and prosecute them. The other is, can we find enough fraud that in fact would overturn this election? I don't see how in the world we could do that. I really don't. And the time, of course, is rapidly running out for the president. So pretty soon we're going to have to get used to the idea, whether you're thrilled or very depressed, that Joe Biden's going to be the next president. And there doesn't seem to be any way that that will change. I think that there is ample evidence of fraud. I've yet to see enough evidence to turn around the election. And that of course, is the key thing.
Now, do you feel that if any election, you know, within our lifetime, modern history, there have been so many contentious presidential elections, if they were scrutinized as much as this one, that the same amount of fraud would be found? Because you mentioned a moment ago that, you know, there's fraud in every election. How do you think this election compares? And this is just your gut, obviously. You don't have the meter. But how do you think this election compares in terms of general level of fraud to other elections we've seen?
It is gut, yeah, and my thought would be probably more. I think we invited a lot of fraud very seriously. This mail-in ballot obsession that we've had in some states, sending out a ballot to every registered voter, when on average about 8 to 10% of of every voter registration roll in the country is incorrect by virtue of people who've died or people who've moved away. I personally once discovered I was a registered voter in Illinois and Maryland simultaneously. We invited at least the potential for fraud, and we should get away from that. We should get away from anything digital. Voting should be done on paper ballots, and counting should be done in tens of thousands of schoolrooms and firehouses across the country, and we should eliminate not only the potential for fraud, but also we should eliminate the perception. Paper ballots don't eliminate every way in which someone can cheat, but they make it so much harder and so labor-intensive that it's probably not worth it. So I think that would go a long way in that direction. But I think that it would be helpful, probably, if a lot of Trump supporters just simply faced the fact that he wasn't a very good candidate at times, and that a lot of people who were willing to give him a chance in 2016 decided they'd given him a chance in 2020, and then they weren't prepared to do it again.
But one of the problems that Trump supporters are having in dealing with this outrageous election is that Trump did about, 10 million votes more this time than he did the last time, or some crazy number more. And it's hard to fathom getting more votes and then losing. But what they don't take into account is just how many people were motivated to vote against Trump. I don't know how you mentioned the word thrilled about Biden. I don't know if anybody's thrilled about Biden. I think they're thrilled
about
Trump.
This had nothing to do with Joe Biden. You could have put a generic Democrat on the ballot, or I'm not Donald Trump on the ballot. This was a referendum on Donald Trump. And yes, there was a much higher turnout because he was the issue from day one. And again, as I say, Joe Biden was an afterthought. There were hardly any people out there who voted for Joe Biden because they passionately liked Joe Biden. No, it didn't happen.
We're talking about schoolhouses and firehouses and paper ballots. What do you think of the idea of having it be a holiday? You know, do everything you can to make the vote turn out. Have it either on the weekend or just have a holiday. Close businesses or as much as can be done. I mean, we can't even close businesses during what we call lockdowns. We're in such a different kind of an economy and a 24/7 society. But what do you think of that idea?
I think it's a wonderful idea. I think it should be on the weekend. I think we should have probably a 48-hour voting period from, let's say, 6 p.m. Eastern on a Friday to 6 p.m. Eastern on a Sunday. And that would every religion who has a special day, you'd still have a period to vote in there when it wasn't your special day. I think that would be a perfect thing. I mean, the whole Tuesday thing had to do with taking a day to go to the marketplace. I mean, that goes back to the days of the 18th century and the founding fathers, for Pete's sake. It's a total anachronism. And, of course, the idea that we do this in November, one of the worst months of the year for weather, I mean, why do we do that? Mm. To after the harvest? Is that why? I mean, there are a lot of things that we do that really don't make any sense, and your idea of a holiday and or the weekend is a much-needed reform.
Well, I certainly can't take credit for the idea, but I've heard it, and I've heard it over the years. But, you know, it seems that this year, 2020, is a pivotal year in terms of how we come to terms, if you pardon the redundancy, with the new society of the 21st century. You mentioned paper, not digital. I mean, we're dealing with the upsides and the downsides of this extremely modern era into which we're hurtling at light speed.
Well, I'm aware of the fact that there are great advances being made, but the mere fact that you can do something doesn't mean that you are required to do something or even that you should do something. Just because something is new does not automatically make it better, and just because something is old does not automatically make it worse. And yet we are obsessed with this notion. I remember one time I bought a cell phone from some 20-something, and they pointed out to me, of course, you'll need to buy a new one in 2 years. And I said, really? Why? And they said, oh, well, it'll be obsolete. And I said, it'll still do everything I want it to do, right? But there'll be so many new things for it to do. I said, well, I'll get another one if I feel like I need something new. I mean, and we were not even talking the same language for this little snowflake. And yes, I am being condescending, and deliberately so. This was just full disclosure. the end-all and be-all of the universe is to have the latest cell phone. I have no doubt that this person stood in line for 48 hours to get the latest cell phone. I have no doubt that this person did that. So, yeah.
Well,
again, we are obsessed with the notion of anything new.
In some ways, for young people, technology is the rock and roll of the 21st century. You know, it's like waiting online to get tickets for a concert. It has that kind of social implications. I'll tell you what bugs me is when the obsolescence is planned and forced upon you. That's nationally syndicated radio talk show host Jim Bohannon of the Westwood One Radio Network. You can learn more about Jim at jimbohannonshow.com. Coming up next, a swing out to Las Vegas, Nevada, and a catch-up call with Talkers Heavy 100 radio host and COVID-19 survivor Heidi Harris. You're plugged in to the Michael Harrison Wrap. Bernadette Duncan spent 26 years as a radio talk show producer. In her new book, Yappy Days, Behind the Scenes with Newsers, Schmoozers, Boozers, and Losers, she shares her adventures in the trenches of big-time talk radio during the changing backdrop of America's pre- and post-9/11 realities. This exciting story includes Bernadette's impressions of the quirky celebrity talk show hosts whom she served during her career: Larry King, Sally Jesse Raphael, Gil Gross, Tom Snyder, Lou Dobbs, Charles Osgood, and more. It's full of anecdotes about hundreds of high-profile guests from media, show business, and politics, also quirky, ego-driven, and neurotic. Yappy Days, Behind the Scenes with Newsers, Schmoozers, Boozers, and Losers, an analytical look at the media, journalism, and the complex nature of ego. Get it now at Amazon.com. Continuing now with the Michael Harrison Wrap. Las Vegas, Nevada is a microcosm of the heavy-duty COVID-19 era issue of lives versus livelihood. And we have Las Vegas covered by radio talk show host Heidi Harris, who hosts the mid-morning program on KMZQ Radio. Heidi brings her conservative perspective to the airwaves, as well as the experience of being a COVID-19 survivor. How are you feeling now? You're several months beyond COVID. Any lingering effects or any problems?
You know what? I feel good. I'm really back to normal. You know, it was lousy, as you and I discussed in the past. It was lousy. It was like really bad flu. But I feel fine now. I feel like I'm fully recovered, and it's been great.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. Because, you know, you hear different things. And what's your take on all the stuff coming down about the vaccines? You've been talking about it on the air?
Yeah, you know what? I think a lot of people are putting all of their stock in this vaccine, and I think that's the wrong thing to do at this point. We're certainly not going to be over this right away. First of all, there's not going to be enough vaccine for everybody who wants it. Secondly, a lot of people don't want it, and we don't know how effective it is. And to try to get people to go back and get a second jab, you can't get people to show up in court when there's going to be a bench warrant issued if they don't. I mean, it's real difficult to herd cats. And so there are also a lot of side effects the doctors are reporting to getting the jab. And if people get the first jab and they get all kinds of side effects and they feel terrible, they may either say, I'm not getting the second one, or I'm scared. Oh my gosh, this isn't what I expected. So there are a lot of things that still need to be worked out before the vaccine, quote unquote, saves us, I think.
Well, what do you think about, and again, it is still political, it is still controversial, the other methods of forestalling the spread of this terrible thing through masks, social distancing, and, if I dare say the word, lockdowns. What's your take?
Well, I think it is. I think that there's a lot of evidence that shows that these aren't necessarily working. People have been wearing masks for months, and it's not stopping the spread. I mean, our governor, who shut down the state repeatedly, already got COVID himself. So as far as I'm concerned, he can take the word mitigation and remove it from his vocabulary, because he has no idea how to mitigate COVID spread in his own office. And he's not the only one who got it. The guy who's the head of his COVID response in Nevada also got COVID-19. So apparently what they're advocating is either not what they're doing or doesn't work.
Well, do as I say and not as I do has been a big embarrassment for a number of politicians, as of late. And, you know, it's like, what are they thinking? You know, how do they think they can get away with that? You know, going on vacation and telling the people in your state to stay home or, you know, don't get together in big parties and make sure you wear a mask. And then they find you at a party with with all your friends and cronies, you know, eating at a table and not wearing masks and not social distancing. The hypocrisy is extraordinary, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And it's always fun to talk about with these people who, you know, the one California woman who banned outdoor dining and then was caught outdoor dining. I know you're aware of that story. So, yeah, you know, the truth is, these people are enjoying the power. When this thing first started, I thought, okay, a lot of people said, well, this will be over November 4th. You know, this will all be over when Trump gets reelected or whatever, right? Well, as this continued and the politicians seem to be enjoying more and more power, I realized it wasn't going to be over. And then the vaccine became political. You know, if a vaccine came out under Trump, it was not okay. If it came out under Biden, it was okay. And I mean, the ridiculousness that continues, and I'm not going to get it. It's got nothing to do with who the vaccine was created by. I'm just very suspicious about the fact that it was rushed to market. Plus, I've already had it, so I don't want to get it. But some of my concerns that I had early on, and I'm sure others had them too, are now being being proven to be well-founded. They're going to start possibly having some kind of a vaccine passport in order to enable you to fly, which is a big deal, right? That's a concern. Certain occupations may be required to take the vaccine. I've read other accounts from various people who think that religious exemptions or religious objections should not be considered valid in this situation. So there's a lot more to shake loose on this vaccine story. And I know everybody's cheering it, but I don't think it's the final answer. Certainly not for now.
What's your impression of former presidents Obama, Clinton, and Bush joining forces to sacrifice themselves as you know, guinea pigs to take the jab, as you say?
Well, first of all, we don't know if they're actually going to do that, do we? You know, they could sit there and they could have, water put in their veins or in their arm. We wouldn't know what it really was. So I don't really know if that's true. And listen, I would never tell anybody they shouldn't get it done. If you want to get that vaccine, go ahead and do it. If you've got concerns or you work in an occupation where that's kind of be expected, then fine. I would never tell somebody not to do it. I certainly wouldn't tell listeners, give them any kind of medical advice about that. I just don't want to do it because I'm just not sure whether it would help me already having had it. Or how effective it's going to be or what other possible side effects there could be. I'm just not confident in it. And I've talked to a lot of people who said, yeah, I'll just wait and see how it affects other people before I decide whether to take it. But then the question becomes, if there are terrible side effects in the general public once the vaccine becomes available, are we going to even know that? Because of all of the censorship that's occurring now in social media and with Google and all these things, are we even going to see those stories? That's the question, too.
Well, we have to read and watch and listen beyond social media and Google, yes, and Facebook for sure. I mean, that's a whole other topic. And it's one of the hot topics this week in the national conversation as we're covering it in Talkers. So one more thing. I mean, one of the things that you have been very effective in doing on this program has been putting out the word to the nation of just how painful it's been economically in Las Vegas and the plight of the workers there. What's the latest on that?
Well, it's still tough. Our unemployment rate's about 13%. A lot of the hotels that are open are now starting to close back down during the week. Not all of them, but many of them. The fact is, Michael, as you and I have discussed in the past, many of the hotels built in the last 30 years were built on top of tons of convention space. In the case of the Mandalay Bay, they have 2 million square feet of convention space that they're sitting on top of. And that was obviously how they were expecting to fill the hotel rooms. And conventions are not coming back. They've not been here this fall. They're not coming in the spring. They don't come in the summer because it's too hot. So we're waiting to see if things are going to change next fall. But that's another aspect of the vaccine that is kind of connected with the Vegas economy. Because if we're going to have conventions, and some people may not ever come to conventions again, they may just do it virtually, but other people may say, well, you know, as a company, I don't want to send my people from another country to America if they get the COVID while they're on vacation. They could sue me, but the employee says, I don't want to get the vaccine. So once again, it's very much connected, and it's very concerning about the future of America, of Vegas, for sure.
That's talk show host Heidi Harris, heard mid-mornings on KMZQ in Las Vegas. Her website is HeidiHarris.com. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap. Let's pivot now from the right to the left, and a visit to Los Angeles-based nationally syndicated talk radio star Stephanie Miller. Stephanie is one of the longest-running and most successful voices of the left on American News Talk Radio. She's also the star of the groundbreaking Sexy Liberal Virtual Tour. Ironically, Stephanie is the daughter of William Miller, who served as Barry Goldwater's vice presidential running mate on the ultra-conservative GOP ticket back in 1964. Biden's going to be president. How will that affect you?
See, most of talk radio, right-wing stations, don't believe even that. We don't even have that set of facts.
I know. Wasn't that a daring statement? Wasn't that a daring statement on my part that I said Biden's going to be president?
Oh, my God. That would be shocking news to everybody in talk radio, wouldn't it?
And it's like out of the blue, all of a sudden, we're getting these civics lessons. And I don't mean this to be partisan,
honestly,
folks.
Michael, we've had these conversations for years. You know, this is not only not my dad and Goldwater's party. This is not a party based in any kind of reality anymore. They think there was massive voter fraud and that Donald Trump won in a landslide and that COVID is a hoax. I mean, how do you move forward? We're not even debating issues anymore with each other. I mean, it's just this party, like Donald Trump, has just gone insane. And
are you worried about
working to subvert a free and fair election in America right now by parroting and not saying what you just said. Joe Biden was elected president.
Yeah, I know. Believe me, when I said it, I said to myself, whoa, I can't believe I'm being so daring. You know,
Look,
I try not to get partisan about it, but the fact of the matter is that the same people that are saying the media doesn't anoint somebody president-elect, the electors do that, and we're not a democracy, we're a representative republic. They were the first people to call Donald Trump president-elect 10 seconds after.
I got to ask you, Michael, what is talk radio going to do? I mean, I have to say, even Rush Limbaugh has gone off the reservation to kind of say, you know, there's no evidence here. They didn't produce any evidence at this press conference.
Well, there's various levels of angst among the conservatives in terms of how they deal with Trump, and that's a whole other issue. But
right.
I asked you a question, and I really am interested in a broad strokes response. How does it work for a progressive entity as yourself and your team to deal with a Democrat in the White House as opposed to a Republican? Does it change the nature of the game?
Well, no, Michael, because as you have always said, it's about entertainment. And so people said that, trust me, when Bush left, oh, no, what are you guys going to talk about? You're not going to have anything to do with this. And then it became all about the Black Kenyan in the tan suit. And, you know, you go on defense. I mean, we're going on defense now politically, but the game never changes in terms of what's funny, what's entertaining. And the other thing is we make fun of both sides. I mean, we make fun of liberals. I mean, we fight with the far left sometimes, you know. I mean, it's
okay.
Let's talk about
the far left, because this is important. Do you think that there is going to be, as we get past January 20th, an ongoing schism, debate, and hostility between different factions of the Democrats, the far left versus the centrists, the Biden group versus AOC?
Yeah, the media always wants to frame Democrats in disarray. I mean, they're still focusing on what are the 72 million people that voted for Trump? What about the 80 million people that voted for Biden? Why don't you go interview some of them in diners? You know, the vast majority of the American people that are sane. You know, I mean, why are we always asked on the left, what do you think about your party's slide towards socialism? Why aren't they asking everybody on the right, what about your party's slide into fascism? I mean, you know, my dad was a Nuremberg prosecutor, Michael. I know fascism when I see it. And it's, you know, this autocracy that Donald Trump is apparently trying to create. It's just the party of Trump. It's a cult now. It's not even a party with conservative principles, really, you know. So I don't see, I mean, honestly, you know, all that name-calling stuff. I mean, trust me, I voted for Elizabeth Warren in this primary. And I still get called a neoliberal establishment hack. I'm like, how can you be an establishment hack and work in your basement for frig's sake.
So a lot of people ask my good friend Michael Reagan, what would your father think about the current issues today? And he has his answers. What would your father and his running mate Goldwater, if you're capable of reaching back in time and putting it in today's context, what do you think that your father and Goldwater would have said had they gotten a glimpse of what's going on today?
Well, I know that no living member of the Goldwater family, I think save Barry Jr., supports Trump. You know, my dad's been gone, Michael, since 1983, so I can't speak for him, but I know what kind of man he was, and I think he would be disgusted, like most Republicans are, you know, that it's not like there's only, you know, the six people in the Lincoln Project. I mean, there's a ton of former Republicans and Republican officials and whatever that have obviously endorsed Biden or spoken out against Trump. So, I mean, it's he'd be disgusted. I mean, Trump is not just that he's, he's just Trump's being Trump. He's a traitor. You know, he's a traitor and he's a criminal. And I believe with my whole heart he's going to end up in prison, or he certainly should. I mean, at this point, it's already almost too innumerable, the amount of crimes that and I don't think that we should move on as a country. I don't think we can create that kind of precedent. You know, my father stood for the rule of law, that we're a nation of laws, not men. And we can't just go, all this whole Trump nightmare, let's just put that behind us, you know? I mean, you know, they're debating now, is it safe to keep giving him, you know, classified secrets? It's like, no, it never was. He, you know, as many security officials have said, he's the number one national security threat to America. And it's, you know, you think of his $1 billion in debt, and, you know, that the man's never done anything in his life that isn't to benefit himself, particularly financially. I mean, it's just, I'm still terrified for the rest of this transition. I mean, I was 50 days. Oh, my God. You know, they're already saying he's doing everything he can to, you know, to tie Biden's hands, to subvert, you know, and you're like, that's America. He's doing whatever he can to undermine America. I mean, it really is just kind of extraordinary. He's not any kind of Republican. He's just, you know, he's just an aberration, you know, that I don't even know how you explain him. But
that's nationally syndicated radio talk show host and one of talk media's most influential voices of the left, Stephanie Miller. Her website is stephaniemiller.com. If you'd like to hear the entire 1.5-hour conversation from which that dialogue was extracted, check out this week's podcast, The Michael Harrison Interview, at mhinterview.com. Coming up next, a conversation with a Chinese-American businesswoman and radio talk show host who spent her teenage years in a CCP labor camp. You're plugged in to the Michael Harrison Wrap.
Attention homeowners, spending more time around your house means you're putting more stress on major appliances that keep your home running. Like many Americans, a major breakdown could be very costly during these uncertain times. AC unit goes, that's $4,500. Water heater breaks, $1,500. When you own a home, it's always something. If you have a home warranty, those repairs could cost you nothing. A Home Service Club warranty pays for the repair or replacement of your home appliances and systems when they break down, even from normal wear and tear. For about $1 a day, you can cover your home appliances and systems. It's not a question of if they'll break down, it's when. If you call now, you'll get your first month free and $75 off your first year. Make home appliance repairs one less thing to worry about. Call 800-259-1604 now for your free quote, free first month, and $75 off your first year. 800-259-1604 now. That's 800-259-1604. Again, 800-259-1604.
Continuing now with the Michael Harrison Wrap as we discuss the hottest topics of the past week in the national conversation. U.S.-China relations remains one of the key foreign affairs issues week after week on the Talkers Magazine survey. Many Americans who support President Trump's Get Tough on China policies are concerned that the incoming Biden administration will be soft on the Chinese Communist Party. One such individual is a fascinating woman named Amy Hao. Amy is a San Francisco Bay Area Chinese-American businessperson who came to this country years ago as a young woman seeking freedom from the oppression she experienced as a teenager at a CCP labor camp back in China. Amy is now one of the co-hosts of a powerful weekly radio show called China Uber Alles, heard on our Central California Coast affiliate KSCO Santa Cruz, which details and calls out the ongoing war of subversion being waged against the U.S. and its allies around the world by the communist tyrants in Beijing. Amy, how long have you lived in the United States?
About 38 years.
What led to you coming to the U.S.?
Well, it's a long story. For short, I'm a Chinese by birth, American by choice. And I live in China for 30 years. And when I was 13, the Mao started this Cultural Revolution. And when I was 16, and we all been sent down to the very far away from Shanghai. I was born in Shanghai. And for the labor camp to brainwash and to do the harsh labor, it's almost about 10 years, from 16 to 26.
Why was your family sent to the labor camp? What was the situation that led to that?
Yeah, the situation, since the communists took over 1949, so they divided the country by the class, social class, you know, different class. So my father owned a business, so they immediately becoming enemy of the state.
So
and especially during the Cultural Revolution. And so those, we are the children of the enemy. So they had to send us to the labor camp.
So all people that owned businesses prior to the Cultural Revolution were considered to be enemies of the state?
Yes, yes. First, they wanted to, when they took a power, so they don't want to financially paralyze it. So they just tell the people own the business, you still can do business as usual. You can do anything you want as usual. And so they're not going to flee to Taiwan or Hong Kong or abroad. So they were still run the city, run the country. And then eventually they said that we're going to buy you out. They issued some stock, which was never paid off. And they basically is confiscated.
How did that change your life? Did you lose your freedom? Were you actually behind barbed wire fences? What was life like in that situation?
Yeah, in that situation, and we just had to do very harsh labor in the camp, and basically 365 days, because the place I went is near a border of China and the Burma, and not called Myanmar, right? Mm-hmm. And was a very primitive place, and nothing, but we had to work. They do the rice field we're working on, about three crops a year. And the communists took over China, and they taxed them heavily. So only half year, 6 months, we have a food. Another 6 months, you had to dig in the roots and looking for other things, the wild plants to fill in your stomach.
Were you separated from your family during those years, or was the family kept together at the labor camp?
No, separated.
Did you ever get reunited with your family?
No, after 5 years straight in the field labor, and then they say the Cultural Revolution almost over, so the school gonna reopen. So we have a chance to go back to the school. but that we already missed the high school, so we had to study, self-study, and take an examination, and then have a chance. But for people like me, have this bad family background, so it's only have very little chance, I don't know, 1,000 or 10,000, and if they decided that you've been reformed well, so you have a chance to go back to the school.
And how old were you when that happened? When you went back to school, how old were you then?
About 21 years old.
And did you have your freedom from the camp, or was that still living in the camp and going to school? How did that work?
No, school is in the city. I get a chance to actually go back to Shanghai, the Institute of the Science and Technology. So they accept me, but they run this background check, and they found out that my father, the business associates, they are abroad, so I cannot be trusted and to study anything. So they didn't accept me. And then another local school in Kunming. Kunming is the city capital of the Yunnan province. And so late 3 months later, they coming down, and so they accept me. So I went to the Kunming to study mechanical engineering over there.
What led to you leaving? How did you leave China, and did you go directly?
And then after the school, they send them back to another city, which was the suburb of the Kunming, and they have a little agriculture machine factories. They'll send me there to work. So over there, the bad thing happened to me. The communist office, a secretary of the work unit, they call work unit the factory, and he sexually assaulted me. And during the fight, I injured him. So they arrest me and put me in jail. And that was that's the moment. Long story for sure, I just talk about that's the moment in my life is where I wake up. The snowflake woke me up. I lay down in the frozen ground. I only have one question for my create, and what's the purpose for me to live? Just give me one reason. I asked my creator. I don't know it's because my illusion of whatever singing concussion, or I heard the voice say that if you still have a faith in me, and they still have a faith in humanity, so you have a reason to live. After that, I was rescued. I didn't eat them by the wild dog, but this dog rescued me and then bring the owner. And they're just very nice, kind villagers. So they didn't ask me any question. They just took me in and gave me some food. So I just warmed up and walking into the train station. I have a few dollars, few yuan in my pocket. So I took the train to the Kunming, but I couldn't went back to Shanghai because I was treated as a fugitive. Actually, they did. And they sent to the police department in Shanghai, go to my home to search. But I had to escape to my friend's city. She lived in another city. Nobody know. And so I stayed there for a while. Basically, about 3 years, I was fugitive in my own hometown. Finally, I'm back to Shanghai. And then I have no, in China, you have to have resident permit to live in your own home. But I don't have that because I escaped from that place. And so about 3 years, I was fugitive. And finally, in 1980, my aunt, she lived in the United States, and they come in to visit. So her husband is American. And so they decided to sponsor me as a student to United States. So that's my story.
That's Chinese-American businesswoman Amy Hao, co-host of the weekly radio show China Uber Alles, heard on our affiliate KSCO in Santa Cruz, California. For more information, please visit ksco.com. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap. We got time for one more. Let's visit now with our international woman in the nation's capital, the executive director of the D.C. radio company, Victoria Jones. Well, Victoria Jones, with the spike in the COVID numbers, everybody's watching Netflix again. Of course, Netflix in the generic sense. We're also talking about all the streaming services. But Netflix seems to be the Kleenex of streaming services right now. So let's look at Netflix, because The Crown has its season 4. People have been waiting for it. In my opinion, it's a magnificent show. But the performance of X-Files star Gillian Anderson as Margaret Thatcher and Olivia Colman as the Queen brings some very interesting history from back in the 80s here to 2020. And what's so remarkable is that the old left-right conservative versus progressive, traditionalist versus mover and shaker was happening there. And it is a complete parallel to what's happening in the United States right now. You were probably a young girl growing up in England during the reign of Margaret Thatcher. How do you remember her?
I was. I remember her. I remember thinking that she seemed hard, and she always had this handbag, but then so did the Queen. But she just seemed hard, and she didn't seem sympathetic to people, whereas the Queen did seem sympathetic to people, although I'm not sure really that the Queen really had any more understanding of people than Margaret Thatcher did. And it's interesting, you know, because the Queen does seem as though she has far more understanding of people in this. And yet, when you think about it, actually, she is far more distanced from regular people than Margaret Thatcher, who grew up as the daughter of a grocer.
Yeah, that's the irony. Margaret Thatcher was looked upon by the average folk, by the working people, as being heartless, not caring about the immediate problems of people putting food on the table and getting work, whereas the Queen seemed to care about the people of the UK, almost as if she were the one that had suffered or had known poverty as a child. How that happened, of course, I won't know for sure. We're watching the Queen. I call it the Queen. We're watching the because he wrote the Queen. We're watching The Crown, written by Peter Morgan, who also wrote the movie The Queen, who also wrote, Frost Nixon. I mean, Peter Morgan seems to be the guy that's putting words in the mouth of all of these iconic British people. He's a remarkable writer.
He is, and it's actually not endearing him to the British government, the conservative British government right now, who really wants the series, particularly in season 4, where you've got Princess Diana, to slap on this series. This is fiction.
Well, is it fiction? Because all histories have to have a certain amount of poetic license, because nobody knows the dialogue between people behind closed doors. So as long as the major issues and the timeline is okay, which they distort just a little bit in The Crown, I think it's pretty likely that it's capturing a greater truth.
Yeah.
That's Victoria Jones in Washington, D.C. And that brings us to the conclusion of this latest installment of our show. This has been the Michael Harrison Wrap, looking back at this past week of Monday, November 30th through Friday, December 4th, 2020. Looking ahead, I'm sure we'll have plenty to talk about next week, including the ever-lurking unknown factor. That unanticipated surprise story could take the national conversation spinning off in a totally unexpected direction. We sure do live in interesting times. I can be reached via email at michael@talkers.com. My podcast, The Michael Harrison Interview, can be heard at mhinterview.com. And if you want to stay in touch with the inner workings of the talk media industry, please visit talkers.com. And that does it for this week's installment of the Michael Harrison Wrap, an overview of the national conversation. Our producer is Matthew B. Harrison. Thank you for listening.
The Michael Harrison Wrap is a production of Good Phone Communications in association with Talkers Magazine. Copyright 2020, all rights reserved.